Hello and welcome to our special Christmas podcast.
Hello. Sorry.
That was Gareth. We've got lots of fantastic stories for you to listen to over Christmas time from the last two shows that we did, our birthday celebration, and also a special show called Forest that we did in Lopping Hall.
In Loughton.
We had a great time there. In Essex. It was great. Yep. So settle down, get yourself snuggled in under a blanket, maybe a glass of Baileys.
Yeah, I'll go for that.
Mince pie, and enjoy.
This next story is by Maura Valance, and it's one of our Lopping Hall stories, and it's called The Darkest Day. Although the day was wet from the rain, I could smell burning tyres from the fast cars passing. Deep puddles splashed the sides of the street, and I moved back as I felt the water hit my leg. The trees at the forest edge looked dull and dreary. The leaves were falling. Not many were left on the branches. The colours of the fallen leaves were red, yellow and brown, and were piling up in heaps. Others were blowing in the breeze. My face was chilled. As I passed the old rectory with its tower opposite the forest, it looked dark and eerie, yet it was only 2 o'clock, still afternoon. There was no one in sight. I continued walking. I felt a cold air presence spinning round the leaves, lifting them high so they flew past over my head. It was now raining hard. I needed to get a move on if I was to catch the bus at the corner of the lane. I could see an old tree trunk fallen as if it were meant to be sat on. As I walked by it, I saw a pile of old clothes, the rag bag. As I got closer, I noticed a glove was sticking out of the ground. I peered down. There was a shiver along my spine. My heart raced and I felt very shaky. What was it? I lifted the leaves a few at a time. As I parted the leaves, I could feel water dripping down my hair and neck. An icy presence chilled my face, and some thin twigs touched me like a cobweb. Nothing could be seen. Yet I thought I heard a low shriek, and then whimpering like a small child crying. My body and feet felt heavy, as if I couldn't move. Then a hand touched my leg and pulled me into the ground. I could only feel there was nothing to see. I was stuck. I was grounded. I was petrified. In the distance, from the near side of the lane, I could hear horses' hooves, some wheels turning. As the sound drew nearer, I could see a horse-drawn carriage. It stopped where I was lying. A dark figure came over and pulled me up and whispered, "You will be safe now. Come with me to our second life." "I didn't realise I was dead," I said.
Maura Valance, The Darkest Day. Thank you very much. Great story.
This is a poem called Epping Forest by Jenny Hart. And this was written for Lopping Hall. Epping Forest. Soft moss nestles in open glades, glazing fallen trees and earth with green. Beech tower tall as daylight fades, woven branches cloak the evening scene. Ferns unfurl beside a forest pond, like Catherine wheels amongst indented fronds. Flag iris bend and sway in watery ground, and rushes catch late rays like fairy ones. Forest life is settling for the night. A moorhen scurries to protect his mate. Tangled reeds will keep them out of sight from padding fox whose jaws may be their fate. It's time now, a blackbird sings, last chimes before her head falls to her breast. A barn owl hoots, unfolds and shakes his wings. Moonlight's the kind of light he likes the best. The prowling, stealthy fox, alert and tense, listens for a rabbit, mouse or hare. His ears upright allow his keenest sense to catch slight movement in the cool, damp air. The forest's never silent. Creatures prowl, or fly and pounce, or hide, then catch their prey. A vole or shrew is supper for the owl, while small birds sleep on boughs out of harm's way. Moonbeams flit and dance on holly leaves, polishing the shiny, prickly blades. But soon the dawn will break as night recedes, and owl and fox will cease their nighttime raids. Jenny Hart.
Very nice, Jenny Hart. Very good. I really like that. It's a lovely poem. We don't normally do it. Very nice. Okay, so this next story is by James Morton, and it's called Letter from an Ordinary Father to an Extraordinary Son. Son. No, cross that out. Tom. As today's your 21st, a milestone for any man, I thought I'd write a letter to you, and I know you'll never read. Two things spurred me to do it. Number one being Nora. For a landlady, she is an awful. Doesn't bellyache when the rent's past due or when I clutter the hallway with recycling. She's the only person I told about you, or the only person who'd believe it. And it took some convincing. He's your son, she said in a way I wasn't sure how to feel proud about. Write him something for therapy, if anything. And after much deliberating, I think she might be right. Number two occurred 2 weeks ago at the Laundrette. We've got facilities in the boarding house, of course, but they tend to turn my clothes a peculiar shade of lime. So I've taken to doing my washing at Mike's Clean It and Go, where it's been 20p a cycle since the 70s, with no sign of increasing. I had a good 90 minutes to pass, so I picked up a crossword from the assortment of outdated newspapers on offer, only to open up to find your grinning face gleaming back at me through the print. Your shirt was off, and a cluster of tattoos was visible on your upper arms. Tom's Wild Night, the headline blared, above an article I didn't finish reading. It wouldn't make sense to go all Roger Kipling on you. God knows I'm the last person you'll ever dream of asking for advice. I'm sure if time alone hadn't turned you against me, your mother certainly has. But I feel I'd only cement my status as major dickhead of deadbeat dads if I didn't offer a few tidbits of info I only wish someone would have told me when I was your age. Particularly given your, let's face it, unique situation. First off, pal, go easy on the tattoos. I saw in Heat you had another done. You're 38th, apparently, so it's any wonder you haven't succumbed to ink poisoning yet. An eagle across your chest, if I'm right, swooping on its prey. And whilst I could wax on about your skin sagging as you age, don't worry. Just know that tastes change, as life does. And an eagle, when you're 20, may seem like a humongous turd when you're 43. Second, don't spend your money too fast. Don't get me wrong, I'm thrilled you're secure financially, though secure doesn't cover it. Celebnetworth.com tells me you're on $3.2 million a year, which I call a comfortable living. It also says you've once spent $80,000 in a night. I mean, I've never earned anything close to that, so perhaps I can't comment, but just remember, flying high isn't like the films. And once the happy ending's passed, you buy, you can start to plummet surprisingly swiftly. Remember your roots. I see you've changed your surname from Michelson to Maddox, presumably to suit the record label's marketing methods, which I'm fine with, by the way. You also said that George is your dad, which I'm also fine with. It's almost been a decade since he married your mum, so I get it. But remember, you come from a long line of Michelsons, and even if they aren't a part of your life these days, they're still part of your blood. Respect yourself. Last year you climbed Kilimanjaro for charity and had a platinum album in 16 countries, but you still find self-respect can be the most challenging feat. It can help you hold your head up high in the direst of circumstances. Case in point, when you're in a squalid laundrette slotting 20p's into a 40-year-old machine. Value your friends.
I'm not sure who you consider friends these days, presumably the rest of the band. Just know that true friendship is decidedly rare, so if you find someone who genuinely matters to you, be thankful for them and show them on every occasion. Have fun. It's crucial to find the fun in whatever you're doing, whether it's singing on stage to a thousand-strong crowd or sweeping the streets for a living. If I've learned anything, it's what's called spending time for a reason, because it's a currency with incomparable worth. Wasting it is criminal, so watch that you don't. Above all, if you have kids, experience them. Get to know them and find out what type of people they are. The last thing they want is to spend their 21st birthday writing them a letter they never read. Once the 90 minutes were up, I strolled home, laundry in tow and bags. I took a different route than usual, passing it by the old clock tower near Lake Smith's Corner. You'll be unimpressed with it nowadays. It's been left to fend for itself too long. Virginia creepers are beginning twining themselves around the hands, dragging them forward too quickly, so it never tells the right time. The lake alongside it is virtually unscathed, where we feed the ducks on Sunday. When your mother worked the day shift, it was my time with you, and you never set foot in an audition. You won't remember, but you often selected a specific duck to feed and then get frustrated when another one ate what you'd thrown. There were a family of ducks there today, in fact, huddled at one end, and they drifted over, bobbing their heads in anticipation, but my pockets were empty, apart from some polos. I wasn't sure if you could feed those to ducks, so I didn't. Oh, I hope you enjoy today, Tom, wherever you are in the world. No doubt hello or okay will give me the dirt, along with another article spreading slander about you. I suppose I shouldn't read them. They only make me irate. Forgive me. This is a very unusual way to watch you grow up, one I'm not quite accustomed to. Not much left for me to say, really, but happy birthday. Respectively, forever yours, Brian. Cross it out. Dad. James Morton. Lovely story, James. Thank you very much. And that's very good. Thank you.
This is another story from Lopping Hall, and this story came in beautifully illustrated. Obviously, we don't have the opportunity to show you the illustrations on a podcast, but it was lovely. And it's called Forest Child, and it's by Nick J. Gadsby and Stephen Pusey. Once upon a time, a train pulled into Loughton Station. It was an orphanage outing to Epping Forest. Metal tags clinking around their necks, the children marched past the newly built Lopping Hall, up Forest Road, and into the shadow of the beckoning forest. The children gathered in front of one of the great barns of the retreat. Overseers bawled out do's and don'ts. They could play in the forest and spend their farthings at the kiosk or coconut shy. A whistle would call them back for rock cakes and lemonade. One boy wasn't listening. Diggory stood at the edge of the forest. He'd never seen so many trees, so many colours green. Enchanted, he wandered until the yells of his friends grew distant. The only sounds were his hobnailed boots on gravel and leaves rustling. Near Strawberry Hill, a bough creaked. He turned. Were there wolves? It was a girl on a rope swing, silhouetted by sunlight. Dazzled, Diggory ran to her, shielding his eyes. She swung high. He grabbed the wooden seat as it dropped back, but the girl had vanished. The forest was very big and dark. Diggory had wandered far from the path. He shouted out. Suddenly there were red, staring eyes in front of him. He gasped, turned, stumbled, ran blindly. Something was panting, hissing, reaching for him. Ahead he glimpsed the girl from the swing, arms outstretched. From her hands a magical yarn of holly was pouring, encircling Diggory with an impenetrable green barricade. Beyond, the sound of hissing faded. He slumped down, shaking, into a soft bank of moss. Next thing he knew, it was dawn. The girl was standing over him. A holly crown on jet black hair surrounded her translucent face. She had large olive dark eyes, a red berry necklace, and her waxy green dress glimmered. Presently, Diggory remembered his manners. "How'd you do?" he yawned. My name's Diggory. She regarded him quizzically, face shimmering in and out of focus. I mean, he said, what's your name? Holly. Her voice sounded like a drawing in of breath. Hello, Holly. Puzzled, he added, where do you live? Here. She spoke like the wind whispering through branches. What, Loughton? She tilted her head quizzically, watching something behind him. He looked round. A man was striding towards him. When he glanced back, Holly had disappeared. The man had a cloud of white hair, a ruddy face topped a long black coat and fine brocade waistcoat, a dog collar at his throat. In his politest voice, Diggory asked, Please, sir, where's the retreat?
The retreat, he boomed. Why, I'm going there myself. Maitland's the name, lost, are you?
He held out a flabby hand, but his grip was like a claw, and his rasping breath made Diggory's neck hair stand up on end. But he started chatting pleasantly enough.
So, young fella, got yourself lost in my forest, did you?
Your forest, sir. I thought the Queen gave it to the people. Maitland transformed.
What?
He roared, his face purple, bloating, twisting with rage. Red eyes glowed in his contorted face. His skin turned the colour of charred meat, and his hands were now hooked talons.
My forest, he kept bellowing. My forest. Do you know who I am?
Diggory managed a small shake of his head.
I am Mitod, the ancient evil that dwells in Epping Forest. I was the Roman spear-slaughtering Boadicea's children at Amesbury. I was the Viking sword-slaying priests who hid here. I was Dick Turpin's gun at every hold-up. I am the pond where every drowned child was lost. I am the noose of every hanged man. The tree spirits oppose me. Bah! They can never overcome me. He spat. As the Reverend Maitland, I will soon destroy them all. My roads already criss-cross these woods. Soon bricks and mortar will flatten this forest forever.
Blue fire flickered from his clawed fingernails as he spoke. Metod seized Diggory and marched him into Drummond's, in front of the brightly painted maypole. Flicking the ribbons loose, he bound Diggory tighter, threw back his head, and shook with a thick, evil trickle of laughter. Diggory gazed up. Crouched on a branch of a magnificent oak was a ghost-like figure, Holly. She was whispering to the tree. Diggory glimpsed a huge, shifting face in its patchwork of leaves. Behind, Metod was shouting. Diggory smelt smoke. Tongues of orange fire appeared around the clearing. Metod moved into the wood. Above the crackling, Diggory heard Holly and the oak tree calling. Lord of the forest, save us! A gigantic white stag appeared atop Staples Hill, glistening. It was the wisest, kindest, noblest thing Diggory had ever seen. Looking down the slope, it spoke in a huge, hollow voice.
One must fall to save all.
Diggory gulped. Behind him, the oak triad bowed gravely. Oh my, thought the boy. He breathed deeply. A strength rose up inside him he'd never felt before, a fire within. He willed his thighs to move. The pole trembled, shook, then burst out of the earth. Diggory was free. He began to stagger up the hill, maypole still tied to his back. A sudden roar from Metod. Diggory felt him nearby. He couldn't outrun him. As Metod's claws reached out to him, there was an ear-splitting roar and the ground shook. Diggory fell. Half buried in leaves and twigs, he looked up. The oak tree had gone, its great trunk lying where Metod had been. Holly was floating beside him, weeping. She stooped, kissed Diggory, placed a holly leaf in his cap and faded from view. A blur of men ran by, with axes they chopped to break around the fire. The Loughton loppers had seen the blaze and run to help. Diggory was untied and carried up to Loughton Lodge, where the cook made him a mug of strong tea. Mr. Lloyd, the kindly owner, insisted on taking Diggory back to the retreat himself. As Diggory walked into the great barn, the superintendent was making a speech.
Children, your tea has been kindly provided by a benefactor, whom I'm sure you all wish to thank heartily.
All eyes turned. A white-haired man rose from his chair adjusting his dog collar as the superintendent announced,
"The Reverend John Whittaker Maitland."
As the applause echoed, Diggory began to scream. And that was Forest Child by Nick J. Gadsby and Stephen Pusey. Thank you very much for writing such a lovely story.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, lovely.
Okay, this next story is from the birthday special. And this is by Keith Large. And it's called Take Cake and Kisses. Terence Take never had a birthday. Well, not at work, anyway. Sophie, Kyle and Gina all celebrated theirs in November. Then it was a long winter until mine in March. When's yours? We kept asking Terry, who hated the motto, generous giving is happy living. His had always been Terry Take on the make. We asked ourselves, was he born in a stable or delivered during Auld Lang Syne at Grabcott maternity wing? Because it never fell on a work day. We all played the game. Even if ours was on a day off, we'd bring the cakes in as soon as we were back. Yeah. Guess who got his grubby paws on them first? Huh. That's why, last March, I did something naughty. I put a padlock on the fridge.
What the hell's going on?
Shouted Terry. Well, Gina's worried they might get stolen, I replied.
You're having a laugh, said Terry.
Gina's not here today and she's got the key.
You mean there's no spare? And where's the other pair? Asked Terry.
They're off today too. Terry manoeuvred his 20-stone bulk from behind his desk. His size 12 Doc Martens shuffled towards the lock's anusi. Hands shaking, he grabbed the padlock. He pulled and pulled it, refusing to accept the door wasn't going to open. And he shook harder. The plug in the wall socket broke.
Oh my God! The fridge will start defrosting, I shouted.
All the food will be ruined, he replied.
Terry had the look of a man who thought he'd won the lottery, only to discover the syndicate organiser had pocketed the winnings and run off with his wife. This was a birthday prank gone wrong. I agreed to let the others have the day off so they could prepare for the surprise celebration they're taking me to tonight. The plan was I would turn up with a video from my phone of Terry trying to get into the fridge. His face didn't look like a man prepared to sign a release form. My Nokia remained in my handbag.
Are you sure you've not got the key? Asked Terry.
The deal had been Gina kept it, so there was no way Terry could get at the grub. I couldn't remember the last time I'd been left alone with him. He never brought his lunch when he knew it was one of our birthdays. I don't think I've seen Terry without food.
I'll ask the question again, he shouted.
Excuse the pun, but I'd frozen. I could not find the words to reply. If my lips stayed like they were, I wasn't going to be blowing any candles out tonight. If Terry's face remained like it was, I wasn't going to make my party.
You're not going home until we get into this fridge, he announced.
Now, Terry is not my boss. Unfortunately, she was in the next building along with security. I didn't have to take orders from him. In fact, even if I did, why should I? It was my birthday. My fingers trembled as I thought of my 6th lesson crash course in Taekwondo. How the Grand Master told me, if your opponent is big and fat, there's more to go at. Never let the opposition have control. Take ownership. Right now. This is my birthday. I'm going to own it. I wasn't going to be bullied by some tightwad on the take demanding my cream cake.
Have you thought how we're going to get in then? Terry screamed.
My petite feet held firm to the floor, every bone in my agitated body tightened with anger, reminding myself how the world had moved on. This wasn't David versus Goliath, more Reese Witherspoon standing up to a big bucket of too many KFCs. Every birthday is a landmark. Today is a day I make a freeloader pay.
It will cost you.
Pardon? Replied Terry.
You'll have to buy some bolt croppers.
Terry's face turned pale and clammy.
A knee to the groin. My
might not be required. I'd fired the ultimate threat. I insinuated he might have to spend money. Terry fell to the floor, taking his birthday prank too far. Already there were multiple casualties. The tires had not survived him landing on them. They cracked further as I raced to feel his pulse. Weak and rapid, I knew from doing my St. John's. He got into shock. I knew I needed to keep him still and not give him anything to eat. I suppose that was one good thing, having a padlock on the fridge. Terry, can you hear me? I shouted.
No, don't make me pay at the food bank, he mumbled.
Terry, I can't let you eat anything.
His arms moved across his chest, along with a shortness of breath. I'd given Terry a heart attack. Could I get away with a Vinnie Jones hands-only CPR? I reached for my mobile and dialed 999. Help was on its way. The company didn't have a defibrillator. The staff voted we bought fridges for the offices instead. If we didn't have a fridge in here, I wouldn't need the defibrillator. My short arms pushed as hard as they could into Terry's ribs. Would he sue me if I broke one? Would I be charged with murder if he didn't come round? What a birthday. What did you do?
Oh, I killed some tight-ass fat fucker by padlocking the fridge. Sounds like a sex act gone wrong. The mail on Sunday would love it.
I was left with no choice. I'd had to give Terry the kiss of life. He came round as the ambulance crew walked in, with Gina behind, a key in one hand and a film of me snogging Terry in the other. With gritted teeth, I smiled and remembered my motto, "Generous giving is happy living," as my boss unlocked the fridge and handed Terry a cake.
Great. Great story.
Thank you very much. And that was Keith Large.
This is Rhubarb and Coco by Melanie Benn, and it was written for our birthday show. Rhubarb and Coco, Melanie Benn. I watch as Mum moves through the shed, speaking low and gently rubbing the tips of their velvety leaves. "You're in the best place," she tells them. I'm invisible to her, but I wonder if she can still sense me, gliding with her as she walks through the moist wood of the shed. She carries with her a hurricane lamp filled with gas. She knows that even at night, the rhubarb never sleeps. Inside here, they grow better than anywhere else on the farm. With no slugs to bother them, they can lay warm and safe, tucked up in their beds. Mum makes sure that the humidity is just right, the long white candles dotted amongst them gently warming their roots. It was Mum's idea to join two sheds together to give them more space. She bends her head and passes through the doorway cut into one of the walls, continuing along her path, and I follow her. As she stops and pays particular attention to one of the plants, I can tell by the shine in her eyes that something is about to happen. I look at the same spot in between the overarching leaves, and then I'm there. Diving down into the soil, down, down I go, until I can see the rhubarb's roots right in front of me. They wriggle like worms in a mouldy fruitcake, and I watch as the dark brown earth separates. Like time-lapse photography, I'm seeing them close up and moving at their own pace. I'm no longer frightened by this power that I have. This is one of those times I love being able to explore the earth without a body. The first time I pushed my face into the soil, it was like being doused in cold water, such a shock. Gradually, I woke up to being dead. But when I found I could go in and through things, I told myself not to be afraid, that it might be fun. I feel the time is coming near, so quickly I push up, arriving just in time. In front of me, I can see the top of a milky stalk streaked with pink veins. It comes bursting through, reminding me of a stick of rock. I hold my breath as it edges its way through the centre of the yellow flower and wait, knowing that the sound will come. There it is, and Mum hears it too. She delves down and pulls aside one of the huge leaves, and as if in a game of hide and seek, she finds me. Her hand passes through me and I shiver. Inside the house, Mum's too busy. Any trace of me is squeezed to the back of her mind. But I'm never a stranger to my little sister. Marie sits in her high chair and bangs her spoon with gusto on the tray in front of her. She drops it when she sees me. She smacks her hands together and leans forward to take a closer look. She curls her lips into an O, framing my name. I come near and stand in front of her and silently plead. Go on, say Coco. She can't say Charlotte. Coco. She utters back and repeats it when she sees my smile. Yes, I shout, and I want to hug her and dance around the room with her in my arms. It's then that Ewan comes home with Dad. Ewan goes to find Mum in the kitchen and asks her how his cake's coming along. She laughs. That's not till tomorrow. We're twins and tomorrow's our birthday. Ewan will be 13. Mum used to keep the cake a secret, but if asked, I always chose chocolate. Mum and Dad ask, how was school? And I leave and go for a walk. I skim the wheat like I have perfect rollerblades on and head towards a scarecrow, my other brother. He hovers over the ground too and pretends he has a body, masquerading in Dad's old clothes. He's got a terrible smile, the fault of Mum's crooked stitching. His grimace used to make me laugh. He's suspended on a pole, ready to frighten away the birds, but it's me who's really frightened. I've been thinking about Craig Fell and what it'd be like to go there. I used to go with Laura. The first time we went, we saw a raven nailed to the gate with its eyes rolled back. I thought it was blind. My dad said it's meant to be a warning, said Laura. She told me about the body that had been found in the bog. Most of the bog is dried up now, but we were still not meant to go there. I often used to imagine what Pete Man looked like. I saw a picture of him once, his skin all tanned like beaten leather, his hands and legs tied together. They said that he was a sacrifice to make the crops grow. How long had he been there? All his friends and family long gone. Nothing to keep him but maybe the people who killed him. Where did murderers go? Do they stay behind, whispering and gloating in the dark? I suddenly noticed the face of the scarecrow calling me back home. I wish I could have some fun and borrow his head for a joke and look in through the window when it's time for the cake. I could bob my head like a rotten apple and shout, hey, don't forget me. But that's what they're doing. Going on the same as before, as if I'd never been a part of them. So I've started doing things. Sometimes I take things I know they'll miss and I put them in odd places. How did that get there? Dad says out loud when he sees his mug of coffee in the bath. It's getting easier to move things, especially small objects, but people are a lot harder. If I kiss Dad's cheek, he can't feel it, but if I blow on the wind chime you bought on holiday, he hears me. Yesterday I wrote a message in the dust in my old room. I love you, it said. But they hardly ever go in there. No one's seen it yet. I looked for Dad after and found him with a tractor. You're a farmer now, he said to me after Mum and I planted our first rhubarb in the shed. So why did the tractor catch me then, if farming was in my blood? I know it was my own stupid fault. No one's used a tractor since, not even to buy it. Everyone around here knows what's happened. I hear Mum and Dad talking about it sometimes. I listen to them in the fields, in the house, at bed, at night. I wait and wonder where to go. The next day I'm back in the shed. I watch her as Mum places the lamp on the shelf as she finishes her rounds. I spot the jar, or urn as she calls it. I've been thinking about it a lot, and tonight I feel ready. Hiding those things has helped. I practice placing my hands around the curved neck of the jar and see it began to wobble. Think, I tell myself. See it go there. Mum's not looking this way, but I haven't got long before she turns out the lamp. I have to move the jar fast to hit it just hard enough. The jar hangs in the air for a moment, suspended by my will, and I feel jittery with excitement. Then I make it happen. The jar whizzes through the air and hits the corner of the windowsill that's jutting out. There's still time to see Mum's shocked expression, woken up from her reverie. But it's too late. There's nothing she can do as the ashes spill out onto the soil. It's what I've been waiting for. In a while, she starts to pick up the broken pieces of pottery and shake out the remainder of the ashes. Tears roll down her face. It's all right, she says. I'm here. I let myself sleep down and I try to imagine what will happen later. I see them sitting down to eat, the custard just covering the rhubarb. They don't know it's me. Not straight away. They think I'm a memory, like the time I won the swimming gala, but this time the watery lanes will be their veins. The cake comes in, crowned with a halo of candles and the chocolate coating warm and sticky underneath. Ewan, always ready to please, shuts his eyes and makes a wish. I sit bubbling beneath the custard. Then I feel it, like a great tide flowing over the bowl. I'm free and I'm getting bigger, till the whole room feels like it's inside me. Ewan opens his eyes just as the last candle goes out and looks around to see Marie, happily clapping. Do you mind if I have rhubarb? He says. He hasn't forgotten then. The chocolate is my favourite. And that was the beautiful Rhubarb and Cocoa by Melanie Benn.
Okay, this next story is by Rachel Stevenson and it's called Ron's Birthday, and it's for the birthday special. Ron waited for Sid to go out to work before he scattered breadcrumbs for the birds. Sid thought he'd encourage rats, but Ron liked to see the pigeons plunge for bread. He enjoyed watching Swiss swoop after insects out of the window, but he preferred the land-grubbing birds, sparrows, blackbirds, robins. He used the lavatory, showered, shaved, dressed, and then arranged a cardigan over his shirt and tie. He picked up his clipboard from the living room table and looked at the names. Number one, yes. Number two, maybe. Number three, yes. Number four, maybe. Or maybes and yeses. It didn't really help if he was going to dip into TRA money to buy bunting and table decorations than that. He ticked off the items he already brought. Paper, plates, cups, plastic knives and forks, tablecloths, jugs. There was a blank space next to number 10. Had he spoken to them? Even though they lived on the same floor as Ron, he didn't know them very well. They kept themselves to themselves. Foreign couple they were, from Serbia or Slovenia or something. He put the door on the latch and decided not to change out of his slippers. He was only going across the balcony. It was a beautiful day, the sky the colour of his mother's eyes. God rest her. Sometimes he wondered how many more Julys he would see. The rest of the time he felt he had a good 20 summers left in him. Sid would retire next year and he said to Ron that he wanted to upgrade their caravan in Clacton-on-Sea to a bungalow and move out there permanently. But what would the estate do without him? He walked carefully across the balcony and rapped on the door of number 10, but no one answered, so he knocked again. The door quickly opened and the man stood filling the doorway. He was tall with deep-set eyes and dark, curly hair. He looked to Ron like those Maltese gangsters you used to see around Soho in the 50s and 60s, but twice the size. Ron took a step backwards. Is Jana in? He asked. No, said the man. Inside there was a crash. I can hear her, said Ron. Jana? He called through the doorway. There was a silence, but Ron was sure she was there. Hey, said the man, grabbing hold of Ron by the shirt. Just fuck off, will you? What do you want anyway, you filthy old man? Ron felt his bowels contract, but he stood up straight and raised his chin. I want to know, he said, looking at the man's hairy hand on his shirt, whether Jana and her husband could attend our royal baby birthday celebration party tomorrow. The man tightened his grip. I am her husband, he said. What do you mean? You seen another man here? Who? He put his face close up to Ron's and he could smell garlic, onions and a lot of wine on the man's breath. No, not at all. I just didn't recognise you, that's all. The man released his grip and Ron took another step backwards. Could you at least tell Jana that I called? No. And if you ever come round here again, I'll see that you regret it. All right? The door slammed in Ron's face. Looking down, he was ashamed to see a warm dribble on his left leg through his trousers. He was shaking. He needed a cup of tea. He hurried back to his own flat, looking anxiously behind him in case the man came out onto the balcony again. Back in the flat, he put the kettle on and then sat down on the settee. He wished Sid was here. In all his years of dealing with people, he'd never come across anyone like that. He prided himself on his ability to get along with everyone, but the sheer aggression of the man. He'd been so puffed up, like an airbed with too much air in it, waiting to explode. He couldn't deflate. Ron sighed and closed his eyes. He sat for a while, exhausted. He could hear next door's TV, some daytime soap. Ron! Ron! He opened his eyes and saw Sid stood in front of him. What are you dreaming about? You were dribbling and shouting. Oh, what time is it? Ron pushed himself up in the armchair, feeling his back creak. Half past five, you all right? You shouldn't sleep in the chair, you injured yourself. Well, must have been asleep for hours, said Ron. I didn't have any lunch. His neck hurt and he moved it from side to side, rubbing it with his hand. Everything set for tomorrow? Sid asked. More or less. I don't know how many people are coming. The forecast is for rain. It's probably going to be a disaster. Don't be silly, said Sid, touching him on the arm. We did this in 82, remember? Prince William? That was a wonderful afternoon. Don't forget, it's your birthday too. You must remember to enjoy yourself. Let's have a talk after tea, said Ron, about Clacton. Maybe you can have a look on the internet at bungalows. If I sold this flat and the caravan, enough for a little place, wouldn't we? Sid smiled at him. I know this place had a lot of memories for you, but I'd love for us to live by the sea. No police cars waking you up at 3 a.m. No more noise from downstairs. No more stairs. We could have our own garden. We deserve a proper retirement. I'm not gone yet, said Ron. But he smiled and kissed Sid. Looking out the window, he could see a bird, a wren, was it, on the windowsill, pecking about in hopes of crumbs. Sid tapped on the window, and it flew away. Rachel Stevenson, thank you very much. Ron's birthday. Great.
This is Man in the Mirror by Emma Whitby. The Clark's shoebox lay open on the bedroom floor in front of the mirror. They were wearing and listening to its contents while the coast was clear. Hayley's mum was in the kitchen, getting the girls' teas ready. The girls were miming into their hairbrush microphones, donned in fingerless lacy gloves, getting into the groove. The contraband gloves itched a bit, if the girls were honest, and it would be more fun if they didn't have to keep quiet. But Hayley's mum thoroughly disapproved of their heroes, Madonna and Michael, which was worse. Hayley's mum had told the girls that she'd had a few Jackson 5 records in her collection, but he'd been darker in those days and didn't grab his... She lowered her voice to a loud whisper and overemphasised the word crotch while pointing down between the top of her legs. When Hayley's mum called the girls down for their tea, the gloves got stashed back in the showbox with a True Blue cassette and Bad and hidden under some old Smash Hits magazines in the wardrobe. Being Thursday, Top of the Pops day, Sam cycled straight home after tea. Hayley's dad didn't like modern music, he called it a racket, and complained about their heroes' outfits all through the songs. Not like that in his day, no melody, not enough clothing, so it was better to be at home. The worst Sam's mum did was tap her slippered feet and go on about her predictions for the number one slot. Sam, of course, always knew what was number one already from the Sunday afternoon Radio 1 countdown. When they didn't have to go to Grandma's, she would listen to the whole show and tape all the songs she liked. Mum and Dad had brought her a tape recorder for her 9th birthday, and she was really hoping they'd taken the hint that she would love a personal stereo for her 10th. She got home just as the intro was fading, and Janice Long was welcoming everyone to the show. All right, love, just in time, her mum said, answering the door. Have a nice time at Hayley's, did you, love? Reckon your Michael might be number one this week, you know. Hi, Mum. Yeah, thanks. No, it's not him. I'm not telling you, though, you'll have to watch. They snuggled up together on the sofa as the first band came on. Mum had made Sam some sickly, gassy orange drink from the new soda stream. They watched number one, Rick Astley, jigging about Never Gonna Give You Up, a song that years later she would always pick at karaoke. And then when the song was over, Sam decided to go to bed early because tomorrow was a special day. The next day was the 8th of September 1987 and Sam was 10 today. A small cassette-shaped box lay at the end of the bed, wrapped in Mickey Mouse paper. But Sam wasn't interested in that. She wanted to speak to Michael. For the last 2 years on her birthday, he'd been there, just like in the song, A Man in the Mirror. She'd asked the mirror, Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the coolest of them all? and Michael had appeared. Not Madonna, she noted. Bubbles on his shoulder, fingers all taped up in plasters, slicked back ringlets wrapping his fading face. For the last 2 years, Michael had appeared and told her all about his new songs for the year ahead. They chatted for hours about how he came to be in the mirror. He told her he couldn't explain it, what it's like in Neverland, and why he wore plasters on his fingers, and what it was that made him dance in that way that Haley's mum couldn't approve of. He taught her the secret to moonwalking. He got a bit sad telling her about how he'd wished he could have been like all the other kids, living a normal life and riding around on roller skates, eating bubblegum and drinking Coke. And then he'd tell her about all the things that would be cool in the year ahead. The slip-on shoes that everyone would be wearing, the reversible sweaters with cartoon characters, the T-shirts that change colour when you get warm, new romantics, and the pop stars that everyone would be listening to. And with all that useful information, Sam had become one of the coolest kids in town. Where before the others had ignored her, now they wanted to know what she thought about fashion and music and all sorts. And everything she predicted would be popular became popular. And with her predictions, she became cooler and more popular too. She became friends with kids like Hayley and got invited up the park with the older kids. But this 10th year is the last birthday where Michael will really feel like they're friends, that she's interested in him. By her 11th and 12th birthdays, Michael starts to wonder if Sam likes talking to him at all. She never makes eye contact. Maybe she's just using him, like everyone else. He'll offer to sing a new song for her, like he always has, but she will say that she's too busy. Sam will have lost interest in Michael's predictions. She'd be wearing DMs and too much eyeliner and thinking about being less like everyone else. Everyone will be used to taking her opinions seriously, and so will be able to think up her own predictions and will have the confidence to make up her own mind. Michael will continue to prepare for the visit year after year, even when the family move house, when Sam leaves home packing up a few special things which include the mirror. But Sam will have moved on and forgotten about Michael. She won't talk to the mirror anymore, not even on her birthday. And that's The Man in the Mirror by Emma Whitby.
So that's it. That's all the stories, and that's everything for 2013 for us from White Rabbit. We had a great year. Had lots of brilliant gigs, haven't we? And we are currently doing this now in Birmingham. After we're doing the 366 Days of Kindness theatre tour. We've got lots of gigs coming up in the new year for everyone to catch up on. Have a look at the website and come along if you're in that area.
And we've also got some new I Think Comfortably shows next year. The themes we have planned thus far are science fiction and rock and roll, so do check them out on the website. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Thank you to all our writers for contributing to a brilliant year. And happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.